The headlines: Israeli aircraft conducting new airstrikes on Palestinian resistance groups' positions across the besieged Gaza Strip. The EU chief says the bloc stands united in the face of Moscow's war in Ukraine, doing all it can to help Kiev win the war. And a new video showing U.S. police officers violently arresting a young black boy sparks a widespread condemnation of police racism. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizmi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Israeli aircraft have conducted new airstrikes on positions belonging to Palestinian resistance groups across the besieged Gaza Strip. The new strikes targeted Palestinian positions at the center of the enclave and around the city of Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. Israel claims the attacks were launched in response to earlier rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian resistance groups say their air defenses have repelled intruding Israeli aircraft. Israel has increased its strikes on the Gaza Strip amid rising tensions with Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip had previously warned the regime to stop its atrocities in Al-Quds or face consequences of its actions. The latest Israeli raids in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque compound have left a large number of Palestinians dead or wounded. We were joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, to bring us an update. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli regime jets fired at least one rocket about 10 or 15 minutes ago in the south of Gaza City, hitting a Hamas training center. An hour before that, they hit also a Hamas training center that belongs to the Izzedil Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas movement, in an area near Al Burej refugee camp in central Gaza Strip. These Israeli strikes took place, apparently, according to the Israeli regime, as a retaliation for alleged rocket fire from Gaza, although no one has claimed responsibility for such rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian resistance groups responded to the Israeli rocket firing by firing their anti-aircraft machine guns, triggering the so-called Iron Dome missile interception system in the east of the enclave.
Iran's foreign minister has urged the global community and the United Nations to take immediate action to support the Palestinian people in the face of Israel's acts of aggression. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the call in a letter to UN Chief Antonio Guterres, head of the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation and Foreign Ministers of Islamic Countries. He expressed deep concern over the recent developments in the occupied territories, including the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and settlers. Iran's top diplomat says silence of some governments and international organizations has emboldened the apartheid Israeli regime to intensify its inhumane acts and violate human rights of Palestinians. The Iranian minister said the lasting and fair peace in Palestine is only possible through a complete end to the occupation, the return of all refugees to their homeland, and added that the future of Palestine must be decided through a referendum attended by all the original residents of the occupied territories. Political activist Paul Arudi says Israel's aggressions against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including Al-Aqsa Mosque, are rooted in the regime's internal policies and its policy of discouraging Palestinian activities in Ramadan.
They do so for a variety of reasons. Some of it is internal politics to demonstrate that they are in a sense, their argument is that they're defending their country and their system, which is an apartheid system, of course, and that they look more responsible to some people if they perpetuate violence against Palestinians. But also, during the time of Ramadan, when the holy places in Jerusalem are more active than usual, they don't want to see the holy places more active than usual. They would rather not see Muslims at all in the holy places. So they want to take some actions to supposedly discourage such things.
A ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital to honor dozens of journalists and employees of the media outlets who have been killed covering the war on Syria. The ceremony was attended by senior officials and the families of the victims. Muhammad Ali has the story.
The Journalists' Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had double the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The latest on the Russian war on Ukraine. Kiev says efforts to evacuate civilians from the besieged city of Mariupol have failed because of Russian shelling. Ukraine says Russia did not respect a temporary ceasefire in the city as it is unable to control its own troops on the ground. Civilians are said to be trapped at a steel factory in the city of Mariupol. Russia says Ukrainian militants and foreign mercenaries are hiding there. Moscow has already given two ultimatums to fighters in Mariupol to lay down their arms, but both of them have failed. Meanwhile, the European Union chief Charles Michel says the bloc will stand united in the face of, quote, Moscow's aggression in Ukraine. He says the EU will do all it can to help Kiev win the war. Michel made the comments at a press conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during a visit to Kiev. For his part, Zelensky reiterated his request for Ukraine to become a member of the European Union, adding that this is of paramount importance to Kiev. The U.S. imposes more economic sanctions on Russia amid the Ukraine war. New sanctions target a Russian commercial bank, virtual currency mining companies, and dozens of people and entities. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has targeted a global network of more than 40 people and entities whose primary mission is to help Russia evade sanctions. The U.S. and its allies have imposed a spate of sanctions against Russia since the beginning of its war on Ukraine in late February. The sanctions, however, have largely spared Russia's energy sector, despite Kiev's repeated demands. The West has also provided military support to Ukraine. EU legislators say five rounds of Western sanctions against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine have not had the desired effect. The European Commission is currently working on a sixth package of sanctions. Jerome Hughes reports.
EU lawmakers gathered on Wednesday in the European Parliament Brussels to assess the impact of Western sanctions against Russia. The measures target the Federation's banking, energy, transport and technology sectors and more than 800 individuals.
All sanctions adopted so far did not deter the Russian military aggression against Ukraine, and the war is sadly going on.
McAllister went on to point out that the Russian ruble is worth more now than before the conflict began, and the Russian central bank is doing okay due to gold reserves. However, senior EU officials insist sanctions are working.
We believe that these measures have significantly increased the cost for Russia's aggression and placed a constraint on its military capacities.
Some EU lawmakers believe the US and other NATO countries don't want the conflict to end.
They're pretty happy with this war going on. Arms shares have gone up within the five largest US companies. Their shares have rocketed by over 20% since the war started.
Others claim sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than the Kremlin.
No son un mecanismo.
Sanctions are not a way of finding a solution to this conflict. The US arms industry and energy sector is benefiting. The most vulnerable EU citizens are paying for these sanctions whenever they fill their car up or pay their electricity bill.
EU governments have been criticised for implementing agreed sanctions too slowly.
And member states, including my own, allowed oligarchs to quickly move their assets by delaying sanctions enforcement for weeks. It's absolutely shameful.
European Commission officials told lawmakers that an oil embargo will form part of a sixth round of sanctions currently being compiled. The officials pointed out that Russia is the second largest oil exporter in the world after Saudi Arabia, and more than half of Russia's supplies are going to the EU market, generating €45 billion per year for Moscow. EU leaders are divided on how far to push the energy issue over concerns a full-scale oil embargo could seriously backfire economically. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French presidential hopefuls have battled in a much-anticipated televised debate over who will be best placed to improve people's purchasing power and run the foreign policy. Far-right candidate Marine Le Pen hit hard against President Emmanuel Macron's record in office. Le Pen said the French people suffered from government policies during the past 5 years. Le Pen said she has plans to improve people's living conditions. Macron, for his part, accused Le Pen of being dependent on Russia, citing her past admirations of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He added that Le Pen had received a loan for a 2017 presidential campaign through a Russian bank. The debate was their only direct clash ahead of Sunday's second round vote. Some polls say Macron enjoys a 10-point lead over Le Pen in the runoff. Still, undecided voters and abstentions could swing the figures. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent in Paris, Marmin Mazahari, for the reactions to the crucial presidential debate.
What I heard, first reactions and what I've been seeing in the social media is that words like strange, unexpected, curious, and that's because there were no fireworks. I think that's kind of the biggest thing to take away from here. You know, in almost 3 hours, there were almost no personal attacks. There was almost no hyperbole. This is something that's really very different from 2017, back when Marine Le Pen, she was practically heckling Macron. She was really very, she was not very presidential, certainly we can say. And her, you know, poor performance really sort of cost her because nobody took her seriously. It seemed like she wasn't taking this debate seriously. The total opposite, tonight. And that's certainly very, very surprising. So there was maybe no real victor here because this has been a very dull campaign, and it was sort of planned that way to talk about xenophobia and Islamophobia and all these things that the average French person doesn't really care about. So we are expecting near record abstention, and we are expecting record number of spoiled or blank ballots. So it's been a very dull campaign, and now it was really a rather dull debate.
British government has proposed delaying decisions on possible parliamentary investigations into Prime Minister Boris Johnson's so-called Partygate scandal. The probe aims to clarify whether Johnson misled lawmakers in his initial response to reports that pandemic lockdown rules were breached at his office. The government says that the decision should take place after a police investigation into lockdown breaches is concluded. The opposition Labour Party says Johnson repeatedly lied about illegal gatherings at his office and should resign. The vote on the motion is scheduled to take place on Thursday. Johnson apologized to Parliament after he was fined by police for breaking lockdown rules. Despite his apology, he claims that he did not know at the time that the parties were breaching the law. On Wednesday, Johnson said that he would seek to be re-elected Prime Minister at the next election and could not think of any circumstances under which he would resign. A violent arrest of a young black boy for apparently stealing a packet of chips has once again sparked outrage across the U.S., bringing to the fore the issue of police brutality. The incident happened in Syracuse, New York. The viral clip has been watched millions of times on social media, with many users accusing the white officer of racism. The man filming the incident accuses the police of treating the boy like a cold-blooded criminal. Local media reported that the boy, who was later released without charge, was just 8 years old. The New York State governor described the video as, quote, heart-wrenching. New York police said it would investigate the incident, adding that it is also reviewing body camera footage of the incident. In February, a video of police in New Jersey tackling a black teenager during a mall fight with a young white man sparked outrage. It prompted the state governor's condemnation to what appeared to be racially desperate treatment. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program.
A hadith from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, reads that in every night of the blessed month of Ramadan, God forgives millions of sinners, and in the last night, he forgives as many sinners that he has forgiven throughout the month. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, also says that in the month of Ramadan, God assigns the angels to seek forgiveness for those who fast, and in the last night, the angels give good news of forgiveness of all their sins. So let us repent and beseech to God to forgive our sins in the remaining days and nights of this blessed month. As the proverb reads, "Procrastination is the thief of time." According to the Islamic teachings, procrastination is one of the tricks of Satan. In other words, Satan keeps telling us that there is time to repent, whereas nobody knows when he or she will die. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Penitence means regretting by heart, seeking forgiveness by tongue, practical abandonment of sin, and decision not to commit it again. Such penitence is called Tauban Nasuh, or pure penitence, penitence with no return to sin. The Prophet of Islam used to seek forgiveness 70 times every day while he was infallible and immune from any sin or mistake. By the way, how should we seek forgiveness and repent with so many sins? Well, we should never lose our hope in God's mercy. Despair of God's mercy is a great sin itself." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Any servant who regrets the commitment of a sin, God will forgive his sin before he seeks forgiveness. But we should heed the fact that insistence on sin and appealing to God for forgiveness is a kind of ridiculing ourselves. The best time for abandoning sins is the blessed month of Ramadan." Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, says that God weariness is the prelude for penitence, and God has made fasting of Ramadan a prelude for God weariness. Now, in this part of the program, let us mention some of other things that nullify fasting. A frequently asked question in this regard is the activities related to dentistry. Generally speaking, none of the activities at the dentist nullifies fasting, provided that nothing goes down the throat. However, it is better to go to the dentist after iftar, as most of the dental treatments include bleeding and it is hard not to swallow blood. All of us know that the aim of fasting is not solely abstaining from eating and drinking. There are lofty spiritual goals in fasting, so that Imam Baqir, peace upon him, says, "Islam has been based on five things: prayer, zakat or almsgiving, hajj, fasting, and velayat, or God-given authority of the Prophet and the infallible Imams." According to this hadith, fasting is one of the pillars of Islam. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, said to his companion Jabir, "O Jabir, anyone who enters the month of Ramadan, fasts in its days, spends its nights in prayer and supplication, keeps his rebellious self away from mean desires, his tongue from any forbidden saying, his eyes from any forbidden sin, and his disturbance from people, he will come out of his sins like the day in which he was born, and he will have no sin." Thank you. Imam Baqir Pisepanhim says that the most important way of controlling the self and salvation is to be God-wary. He wrote to one of his followers, "Indeed, God safeguards the servant against what is hidden from the reach of intellect through God-wariness and compensates his blindness and ignorance through God-wariness. It was through God-wariness that Noah and his companions were saved on the ship, and it was through God-wariness that Saleh and his companions were saved from the thunderbolt. And it was through God-wariness that the patient have been successful and those groups were saved from destruction." The Prophet's fifth infallible successor has also said, "Everything has a spring, and the spring of the Qur'an is the month of Ramadan. Recitation of the Qur'an and pondering on it leads to self-building and salvation from absurdity, aimlessness, perversion, and corruption. We appeal to God to help us to be careful of every minute action and thought in this month so that the way is paved for us to be God's true servants and gain His proximity."
Food for thought.
Salam everyone, and let us begin the day by contemplating upon what the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, has to say regarding the correct ways of fasting and worship, that is, sincerity and firm faith in God. "Many are the people who fast without partaking of anything except hunger and thirst. Many are the worshippers who do not partake of anything except sleepless nights and hardship. How excellent is the sleep fasting of the wise, which is better than the vigils of the fools, and the hours when they are not fasting, which are better than the fasting hours of the fools."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: what is a jurisprudential fasting? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Religious fasting may be observed in three different levels. Number one is fasting of al-Sharia, which is the jurisprudential fasting. Fasting for many Muslims is mainly to refrain from what they must jurisprudentially refrain from, such as eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, etc. Although this is the lowest and the least level of religious fasting, once it is offered for the sake of Allah, the faster is religiously considered fasting. To give you an idea of how long the level or how low the level of this stage is, let me share some examples with you. A Muslim girl may fast without practicing her Islamic dress code at school, and her fasting is valid on this level because, like we said, it's the lowest level. There are do's and don'ts of this lowest level. So if she's not wearing hijab, but she is performing all those other do's and don'ts which are necessary for fasting, then she is considered to be fasting. A Muslim may observe fasting and yet listen to rock and roll, and his or her fasting is jurisprudentially valid. Again, keep in mind that we're discussing the lowest level of fasting. There's so many other vices that a faster may be performing while he or she is fasting, but their fast would be valid at this lowest level. And this is the jurisprudential fasting. And we're going to discuss this more after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the jurisprudential fasting, which is considered to be the lowest level of fasting for any Muslim. No doubt, the purpose of fasting is not just to avoid food and drink, and hence, this is the very lowest level of fasting for the very beginners to start their journey towards perfection and promotion. Keep in mind that this is not the end. This is the beginning.
Thus, it is quoted from the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that many people gain nothing from their fasting save hunger and thirst. Notice how he still qualifies it to be a fast, but he's saying that you don't gain anything more than what you are getting, and that is just hunger and thirst. The Sharia fasting, or the jurisprudential fasting, is prescribed for beginners as a form of training to help them become acquainted to waking up at dawn with the excuse of eating and drinking, lest they feel hungry and thirsty during the day, in order for them to experience the pleasant breeze at dawn, to be awake at a time when the divine cups of spirituality are served. The least he is expected, therefore, to gain by the end of this blessed month of Ramadan is to have gotten used to offering his or her morning prayers on time. This is the least of the expectations. Unfortunately, many people, they're fasting from their childhood, but, you know, they grow older and older and older, but never think about moving beyond this jurisprudential fasting level, this basic level, right? This is a very unfortunate thing. And inshallah, may we not be from amongst those people whose previous year fasts were no different than this year fast. This year, we have to move to the next level. We have to exert ourselves and make sure that we are taking one step further, to say the least. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Magic returns to Belgium with a purple carpet of bluebells covering the undergrowth of Hallerbos woods near Brussels. Each spring, this beech forest turns into a bluebell spectacular, turning the area into a natural wonderland. Millions of these blooming flowers sprout up across the 550-hectare woods, filling the air with their sweet aroma. The short but enchanting blooming phase offers nature enthusiasts a one-of-a-kind experience.
It is an outstanding and magical place because whenever we come, there's an amazing atmosphere. The sunrise was truly beautiful this morning, and we know this offers the opportunity to take great photos and decorate our house. It is a great comfort during these tough times.
Visitors can stroll the winding paths and watch rabbits and deer wandering through the woods. The forest floor blooms for a period of 7 to 10 days. After this time, leaves begin to grow on the trees above them, blocking the sunlight from reaching the flowers. The phenomenon of bluebell forest is not uncommon in Europe, but the Hallerbos greenery is unique for the density and beauty of its blossoms. A huge pink moon has glowed over Chilean skies, mesmerizing stargazers and ordinary citizens alike. The full moon was completely visible over the capital, Santiago. The The celestial phenomenon is called a pink moon, as it appears in April, and is named after an American plant, pink plot, that blooms in spring. The pink moon will shine during the weekend through early Monday and may be visible in most parts of the world. The phenomenon also marks the calendar for different religious festivities around the globe.
A batch of autonomous delivery vehicles has been provided to facilitate personnel and volunteers in the streets and communities of Shanghai. The self-driving vehicles distribute supplies to residents in the Chinese megacity, which is now hit hard by the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The vehicles reduce person-to-person contact and largely lower the risk of infection. A community served by the distribution station has more than 30 apartment buildings and nearly 3,000 residents. The weight of each order is more than 5 kilograms, which puts great pressure on the volunteers to deliver. 49 autonomous delivery vehicles have been sent to communities, colleges, and hospitals in Shanghai to support anti-pandemic and supply work. Sunny skies and spring temperatures made for the perfect setting for the 65th birthday of Fatu, the world's oldest gorilla living at Berlin Zoo. At this age, the Western lowland gorilla is what Berlin Zoo calls almost something of a legend. Gorillas living in the wild have a life expectancy of about 40 years, and at 65, she has been the world's oldest living gorilla for a while. 65 is absolutely extraordinary, and that obviously needs to be celebrated in style.
They mainly get vegetables, and the sugar they receive at most is fruit sugar, and that's what she saw for today in the shape of raspberries and blueberries. They were the decoration on rice cake made of boiled rice, a thin layer of rice and some curd so it sticks together. The bottom was made of a lot of green stuff, then the lion and lettuce.
According to Berlin Zoo, Western lowland gorillas are now an endangered species after their natural habitat was continuously decimated, and therefore fewer and fewer animals live in the tropical rainforest of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo. World of Opera is opening its doors to the deaf community for the very first time. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra has teamed up with the Deaf West Theater to stage a production of Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio, at their home at the Walt Disney Hall. The chorus will be performed by the White Hands Choir, a group from Venezuela consisting of disabled children and young adults who sing as well as sign. The production pairs up a singer and a deaf actor to both inhabit the one role on stage. Having deaf actors perform alongside opera singers, however, has its challenges, not least of which is keeping up the rhythm of the music.
I think probably that there's a lot of tempo that I've been rehearsing. A lot of times when the singers hold the same word, but the next time they say that exact same word in the next few bars, they don't hold it as long. So trying to remember all of those is very difficult. So are they holding this for four beats or two beats? Or what word is this in this thing?
The challenge with opera is that it's very fluid and it's not repetitive. The tempos change throughout it, and night to night it even changes. The conductor, you know, kind of changes how he conducts things each night, and so that is something that is challenging.
The opera singers also give small cues to the actors, like opening a letter or sitting down or standing up, to keep them informed where they are in the piece. The deaf cast use theatrical ASL, or American Sign Language, in the production. DJ Kurse, the producer at the Deaf West Theater, says the performance is a little bit more poetic and a little bit more kind of picturesque.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news and more from every corner of the world.
A startup in the U.S. state of California is turning science fiction into reality by sending tiny robots on a fantastic voyage inside humans to treat brain disorders. The smart cells are small enough to be injected and can be carefully guided through the brain using magnetic coils placed outside of the patient's skull. The coils are linked to a computer that can remotely maneuver the robots through delicate pathways into the affected part of the brain. The micro-robots are also removed by rewinding them through the same route. The developers at Bionaut Labs say these robots are extremely important when it comes to zero-failure-sensitive surgeries.
For localized conditions such as cancer tumors, stroke, atherosclerotic plaque buildup, localized pain, and many other conditions, there is a real need to have a micro-robotic, precise, remote-controlled mechanism that can treat a condition only at a specific point and nowhere else.
The startup has already tested the robots on large animals. Inventors hope to use the robot to pierce fluid-filled cysts within the brain when clinical trials on humans begin in 2 years. If approved, they could offer key advantages over more invasive and dangerous treatments for brain disorders. Floating solar panels help landowners benefit from underused body of water. Now, a German company is covering 14,000 square meters of a lake with these panels, turning it into the biggest solar park in the country. The park is built by a family-owned company called Quartzwerk, which specializes in extracting and processing industrial minerals. The company says it wants to become independent of fossil energy sources amid rising energy prices. The head of the Floating Panel Corporation says they will be generating around 3 million kilowatts per hour of green electricity on the surfaces of Limmersheim Lake in southern Germany.
The
plan can make a super big contribution to the land-neutral energy transition, because here an unused lake that was previously used for gravel extraction is being converted into a power plant for renewable energy.
Installation and maintenance of the panels are easy and safe, while they also offer a significant reduction in evaporation from the water surface. According to the company, this will save around 1,100 tons of carbon dioxide each year.
A restaurant in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta is taking fine dining to new heights, literally and figuratively, by giving diners a one-of-a-kind experience 50 meters above ground. The restaurant is called Lounge in the Sky. Diners are securely strapped into seats fixed to a table and are hoisted into the air using a heavy-duty lift. First, the gourmet meals are prepared in the main kitchen. Then, the food is loaded onto the platform where the dishes are plated and served to the patrons. The suspended guests are able to take advantage of breathtaking views as they gently rotate at great heights.
At first, it was not easy. I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to swallow the food, let alone drink. But after some time, I could eventually eat. It was thrilling.
While enjoying the meals, the guests use seat belts and the accompanying staff are equipped with safety harnesses. The guests are also briefed on safety regulations before the platform is raised. Diners call the one-hour experience exhilarating and worth the high price. The project developers say the restaurant was aimed at reviving local and international tourism sector after a big slump during the COVID-19 pandemic. The culinary experience is a first in Indonesia and the third in the world after Belgium and Malaysia.
South Koreans are getting outside to enjoy the open air with a local cherry blossom festival in central Seoul. This is while the country has been dealing with an ongoing surge of the Omicron variant of COVID-19. With some performances and the beauty of spring, many people look forward to turning the corner on the pandemic. Frank Smith has a story.
Spring has come to South Korea, and the cherry blossoms are blooming. COVID-19 restrictions on gatherings are finally being eased, and at Ansan Park in central Seoul, a small festival is bringing everyone back out.
I first came here with my friends 4 years ago, but we couldn't come for the past 2 years because of COVID. I was impressed to see so many people no longer being overly careful about COVID, and we're also very happy to be able to attend festivals like this one.
South Koreans have been quite diligent in observing social distancing guidelines and wearing masks. The Omicron variant of COVID-19 has been quite severe here, with cases only recently declining below 200,000 per day. Still, the government's decided to open up. From the open-air stage, Noh Ah Ram and his band entertain a crowd that's anxious to finally get outside and enjoy group activities.
Ever since COVID, and particularly for the entirety of 2021, when the pandemic was at its peak, I have been unable to perform. I felt today was a restart. Spring has come, the weather's great, the blossoms beautiful, and I felt all of this was celebrating today's show.
South Korea's vaccination rate is nearly 90%, with children now getting the jab.
At first, I was very scared of COVID as I felt it was life-threatening. But now I feel okay with it because I consider it an experience and a certain reality. Also, I worry less because of the vaccines and the new medications.
The cherry blossoms blooming has been tracked from Jeju Island in the south and up to the capital as warm weather moved north. And with this change in seasons, attitudes toward life with COVID are changing as well. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In England, 2 in 5 people believe that democracy is not working, citing a loss of trust and corruption as the biggest factors. Only 28% trust the national government to look after their interest. Polling in Scotland and Northern Ireland records similarly dismal levels of confidence in the UK executive. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Moya Lotian MacLean, a journalist who writes about politics and digital culture, titled, "Offshoring in Rwanda isn't a dead cat to distract from Party 8. It's just plain inhumane." Please stay with us to hear more about this story. In British politics, nothing is as it seems, apparently. Barely had news of the Home Office's draconian immigration deal with Rwanda broken on Thursday, April 14th, when it began to be proclaimed a political diversion. Journalists and MPs alike invoked the tired image of a dead cat, the phrase associated with the strategist Linton Crosby, to describe the act of willfully talking up one hot button issue to divert attention from another. Members of the public took to social media to agree that, yes, the plan to process certain asylum seekers in offshore centers thousands of miles away was indeed just an attempt to push Partygate off the front pages. Except, this explanation doesn't really tally. Attempts to outsource asylum applications have been in the works for nearly 3 years. Negotiations with Rwanda reportedly took place over 8 months. The plan forms a key part of the breathtakingly inhumane plank of immigration policies the Home Secretary Priti Patel is introducing, a cruel and illegal attempt to make an already hostile environment completely unlivable. So why the conviction that this latest proposal hardly shifting criticism away from Boris Johnson, who took ownership of the policy, is not a means to an end, but a smokescreen to shield him? The specter of the dead cat has been everywhere during Johnson's tenure as Prime Minister. Writing in 2019, the historian Charlotte Lydia Riley implored commentators to cease proclaiming every political happenstance to be a dead cat. She wrote, "The idea that there must be a clever plan behind political campaigns also shows our desire to believe that there is someone somewhere in control," adding, "But in truth, politics is messy. Nobody is in control. The world is not governed by clever people doing clever things." But this paranoid style has only grown, cultivated during the Brexit and Trump years. It is now a mainstay of political conversation. Where is it coming from? A lack of trust is one obvious answer. Westminster is viewed with suspicion across the Union. In England, 2 in 5 people believe that democracy is not working, citing a loss of trust and corruption as the biggest factors. While the Welsh electorate still have faith in their beloved parliament, only 28% trust the national government to look after their interests. Polling in Scotland and Northern Ireland records similarly dismal levels of confidence in the UK executive. The public is also increasingly skeptical of the journalists charged with reflecting the world back at them. Despite a pandemic-induced boost, overall trust in wider UK news reporting only comes in at 36%, 14 percentage points lower than before 2016's Brexit referendum. While this is not quite a full-blown crisis in faith, it speaks to that broader miasma of distrust that has rolled over the land in the past 5 years. Many people don't know quite what or who to believe anymore, as the political identities and givens that previously anchored them have turned to sand beneath their feet. Moya Lotian MacLean wrote, "And so they turn to conspirational thinking. By this, I don't mean people across Britain are signing up to full-blown conspiracy theories about vaccines and moon landings, but rather that we increasingly defer to a knowing cynicism about the world, which always assumes the real meaning of political events is hidden. Rwanda deportation plans are a dead cat. Tighter COVID-19 rules are a diversion. No, wait, relax COVID-19 rules are the real trick mirror. All of these things, slightly feverishly suspicious as they are, sound as if they could